أما المولى ونعم المسير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد
وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Whenever a test is given, or you have to take an exam, there are two reactions in front of a test. Any exam you take, whether it's in school, college, or in your adult life, you face a situation, a problem, catastrophe, or anything. It's a test. Tests and exams, they change. When you are a child, your test is taking your math test or your science test. When you become an adult, right, your test will be losing a job, being unemployed, or worse off, divorce, something else. These are all tests, these are all exams. And whenever someone faces an exam, there are two types of reactions that you see any exam. And the exam is the same. For some people, one reaction is that these people say it was too easy. And some people say it was too hard. One reaction is, when you give a test, you see that the reaction of a student or a person is that, wow, that was easy. And the same test, when another student takes it, he's like, man, it's too hard. That was difficult. Now you see, these two reactions are based on the two different types of people. It's based on two different types of people. Those who worked hard and did what they were supposed to do, for them, when a test is taken, the usual reaction is that, man, that was easy. I mean, I aced it. And those who didn't do what they were supposed to do, instead of doing homework, were playing Xbox. Now for those kids, when they have to take a test, they're sweating. They are sweating. And so now what happens is that they're like, man, this is hard. And when they get a D, they're afraid. Now they have to show their report card to their parents. So what happened is that a person who's good, for him, a test is a way to show his achievement and his ability. A person who's weak, he's afraid of a test because he's afraid that he and his weakness is going to get exposed. This is in all aspects of life. Whenever there's a test in life, you see those who are strong, they welcome these tests. They like these tests. They want to go through these tests. Why? Because by going through them, they can show the world how strong I am. You see, this is my achievement. I aced it. And they want to show and reveal their power. Those who are weak, they are afraid of the tests in life because when these tests are taken, their weakness is going to be exposed and everyone will know what kind of a loser they are. So now, people who are weak are afraid of tests. People who are strong want to give tests. That's why you see a person who's strong in life, when hardship comes to him it's like a challenge that he wants to solve and show that how strong he is. No matter what hardship you go through in life, you see that's how they face it. Weak people, when they face challenges, when they face problems, they are trying to avoid it. They are trying to run away from it. In fact, they are asking for du'as, how we can make du'a or give us du'as that are going to get rid of this bala or this problem or this hardship. These are weak people who don't want these tests because when they go through these tests, their weakness is going to be exposed in front of the world. My friends, if you understand this, you will see a strong person wants a challenge. He wants a test in order for him to show what kind of prowess he has within himself. As an example, if someone becomes the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, right? He becomes the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. This champion is looking for good challengers. Someone who can actually fight them. Someone who can actually go at it with them so that they can show how good they are. Now, if the heavyweight champion is asked to fight a punk fighter, you know, he says, what? Are you going to make him fight me? I mean, this is insulting for me to fight this guy. Really, it would be an insult to his talent to fight someone who's an amateur. He wants a good challenger. He wants someone who can try him out to make the world recognize what kind of talents and skills and power does he have. He wants to prove that. And this is the idea: when someone is good and he knows he's good, he's not afraid of a challenge. When someone is weak and inferior and is afraid of his weakness, he doesn't want a challenge because he goes away from it. He knows he will be exposed by it. This is the reason, my friends, why Shaitan's existence was necessary for mankind. Because Shaitan is a challenge to mankind. He is a test for mankind. He is the ultimate challenge for anyone who has faith. Those who have faith, they want Shaitan to exist because they know when Shaitan exists and he is trying to misguide them, and by them not being misguided shows how good they are, shows the power that they have. And those who are weak, they are afraid of Shaitan because every time they falter, every time they fall, every time they sin, they are living in the humiliation of knowing how weak their faith is. The ultimate test of faith is Shaitan. And that's why Shaitan's existence is the most evident way, the most clearest way to prove who is a mu'min and who's not a mu'min. You want to be a believer? Then be a believer in spite of Shaitan. You want to be strong? You want to be strong in spite of, be strong in spite of Shaitan. He's there misguiding you. He will not leave you. And Shaitan also recognizes those who are weak and strong. He says in the Quran, makes a declaration, لَأَغْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ. I will misguide all of them. إِلَّا عِبَادَكَ الْمُخْلَصُونَ. Except those who are your righteous servants. In other words, Shaitan sees mankind in two groups. One, those who are easy to misguide. And he says, I will misguide all of these guys. And two, he sees the strong people. He says, I can't misguide them. He sees the difference between the two. And we also must recognize the difference between the two groups of people. Which group do we want to be in? Do we want to be a believer and strong and want Shaitan to be around so that he can try to misguide us and we can prove how strong we are by not being misguided? Or we want to be those weak people who are always complaining about Shaitan, that why does Shaitan exist? Why is he around? He's always misguiding me. That shows that you are weak. And this is the reason why Shaitan's existence is necessary. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
If the people from this side can, you know, move this way, and also that, you know, there's people by the door and they're like asking for us to enter. See that open space there by the door. Salawat ala
Muhammad.
So the existence of Shaitan is necessary. You know, I explained yesterday regarding some of the benefits of him. This is why Allah kept him alive, so that our faith can be known. Those who are mu'min can be known. He is the test for us. You know, when we pass all our, you know, simple tests, he is the final exam. That's when you have to really give it. And inshallah, you know, I will explain later in some of the majalis that really we haven't met Shaitan yet. We haven't met him yet. You know, Because really, Shaitan only comes to the champions, those who are strong. Most of us, we fall in spite of Shaitan. I mean, even Shaitan is not needed for us to fall. We fall without him being around. But inshallah, who gets to see Shaitan, we will see inshallah later. But right now, let me go into the qualities of Shaitan. How do you know who Shaitan? Everything has qualities. And Shaitan also has qualities. These are known as satanic qualities that Shaitan has. And Allah mentions these in the Quran. And I want us to understand these qualities of Shaitan. Because the idea of learning these qualities of Shaitan that Allah is explaining in the Quran is for us not to adopt those qualities, not to have those qualities. God forbid we have those qualities, it means that these are satanic qualities that are inside of us. So the first quality that Allah mentions in the Quran regarding Shaitan, He gives the example of Shaitan, He says, كَمَثَلِ الشَّيْطَانِ. Like the example of Shaitan, إِذْ قَالَ لِلْإِنسَانِ. When He tells mankind, when He tells a person, He comes to a person and He tells him, أُكْفُر. أُكْفُر means reject Allah, in many fashion. Not just saying reject Allah. He comes to you and whispers or tells you and commands you to do what? To reject Allah, to reject Allah's commands, to reject Allah's laws. For example, Allah tells us pray. And Shaitan comes, he says, don't pray. Okay, who do I listen to, Allah or Shaitan? You see, Shaitan says, don't pray. Allah says, don't drink beer. Shaitan says, drink it. It's good for you. Right? That's what Shaitan does. Now, he gives you, he tells you, ukfur, right? In all sorts of fashions it comes in, right? For example, you know, Allah says, you know, for example, don't listen to music. Shaitan says, listen to it. It's good. You'll have fun. Right? So now, when he says ukfur, this is what it means. Ukfur. Now, when a person does it, then as Allah says, فَلَمَّا كَفَرَ. And when a person listens to him and rejects Allah, in all these forms that I mentioned, and many more, and that you know of, right? And you listen to Shaitan, and you do what he says, then you know what Shaitan tells you? See, he's smart. He's a politician. He is very smart. You know what he does to you? He says, inni, qala, inni bari'un minka. He says, man, I am bari' of you. You know what that means? Let me put it in layman's term. He says, I have nothing to do with you. You are a loser. When you listen to him, he calls you a loser and says, you are a loser. I have nothing to do with you. Get away from me. That's what Shaitan says. Get away from me. Inni bari'un minka. Get away from me. I have nothing to do with you. Inni akhafullah. I am afraid of Allah. Rabbul alameen. Who is the Lord of the worlds? I am afraid of Allah. Get away from me, you. Listen to, look at his attitude. First he tells you to do something, and when you listen to it, he says, man, you are a loser. Get away from me. Have you met or had friends like that? You know, who would, for example, ask you to do something and then when you do it, they're like, man, you know, get away from me. Right? And they put you in trouble? Well, that's what Shaitan is. That's what he's doing. He makes you do something, he influences you, tells you, and then when you do it, he's like, you are a loser, man. Get away from me. You know, you are just bad. I am afraid of Allah. That's what Shaitan is saying. Inni akhafullah. I am afraid of Allah. You should have been afraid of Allah. You should have done it. So, you know, you're like, but you told me to do it. What, did I force you to do it? No. That's his attitude. So understand the attitude of Shaitan, and this is his first quality. What is his quality? Is that he tells you to do something, and when you do it, he says, I have nothing to do with you. Now, here, I want you to understand something that is a little bit deeper. right? And I will want to explain this so that you understand this in a little bit of depth. So just strain your mind and, you know, make it work and send the salawats. You know, Shaitan, when he is giving you a command, right, he's asking you to work, right? He's asking you to do some work. When he says, "Op for," he says, "Don't pray," he's asking you to do something, right? He's asking you to do something. Tell me, does he have the right to tell you to do something? I mean, does Shaitan have the right to tell you to do something and say that, "Hey, work for me"? I mean, really, who is he to us? Who is Shaitan to us? He's not my father, not mother. Hope not, you know. He is not, you know, like related to me. He is not the resident alim, you know, or anything. He's not my teacher, nothing. The relationship that we have with Shaitan is a stranger. He's a stranger to me. You are a stranger. I don't owe you anything. I don't owe Shaitan anything. You know, it's different if my father tells me to do something. He's my father. He gave me birth, right? So, hey. Yeah, he's a part of it. Don't worry about it. So what happens is that if he tells me to do something, he's my dad. Okay, dad, he asked me to bring water. So now I can't say, well, you know, I don't owe you for anything. You know, I can't say that to him. Right? Then you listen to your dad, right? Or your mother, you know, she tells you to do something, you do it, right? I mean, you owe her, to an extent. I mean, you owe her, right? She's your mother. She took care of you. Tell me, what right does Shaitan have to tell you for something? Can he make you do something? Can he make you say that, hey, you know, bring me some water? Like, who the heck are you? Tell me what to do. I'm not going to listen to you. Really, right? Shaitan has nothing to do with us. He's a stranger. He's a complete stranger. That's what Shaitan is. So Shaitan asking us to do something is a stranger asking another stranger to do something. So now what happens? For him to make you do it, really, he has to promise you something. He has to promise you something in return. You see, my dad tells me, you know, that, okay, son, go get me water, I'll get water. Now, I can't tell him, so what are you going to pay, you know? What do I get for getting you water? You don't say that. But when Shaitan tells you to get water, he says, okay, you know, how much are you going to pay me? Right, so now Shaitan also has to make you an offer. My friends, understand this very deeply. Whenever Shaitan tries to influence you, tries to tell you something, tries to make you do something, he's always making you an offer. He's always making you a promise. Always. My friends, tell me. Anytime he tells you to do something haram, he says, I promise you, you'll have fun. You see, this is a promise he's making. I'm promising you'll enjoy it. This is a promise he's making. This is an offer he's making. Shaitan cannot tell you without making an offer. Now, my friends, just let me explain to you a principle in Islam. And hopefully I'll make a conclusion from it, and from there we understand. Send the salawats. Shaitan, when he tells us to do something, it's like a stranger asking another stranger. For example, I go to a mechanic, my car is having transmission problems. I go to a mechanic, and he says, you know, and you got a bad transmission. So I said, all right. Fix it. He says, all right. So he starts fixing it, gets it all ready. He says, okay, your car is fixed. He says, great, where are the keys? They're in the car. I said, all right, man, thanks a lot for you. You're so kind and so generous. And you start to start the car and go off. He's like, wait a minute. Says, what? Where's my money? Says, what money? Says, the money I work for, right? I fixed your car. I fixed your transmission, so where's my money? He says, we didn't speak about any money. I thought you were a kind person and a generous person. You were helping out. So, what do I owe you? I don't owe you anything. You see, you made him work. Now, when you made him work, this is devious now to turn back on him, since you didn't give me an invoice, since you didn't tell me any money, so there's no money involved. I asked you to do something and you did it, right? See, this is satanic. This is devious. And Islam does not allow this. Islam does not allow this. Even if you haven't ascertained the price for the work that you're taking from someone, whether it's a mechanic, whether it's a plumber, whether it's anything, you can't just say, well, since we didn't agree on a price, I don't have to pay you. No, Islam says, no, you do have to pay him. Now, how much do you have to pay him? Now, here's the issue. Here's the principle. That because the price was not ascertained, because the price hasn't been set, so now there's something in Islam that is called ujratul mithl. Ujratul mithl means that when the price hasn't been set, so now you will go around and see what is the price in the market for such a work by such a person. Whatever the average price is what you will pay him. For example, if it costs you $400 to fix the transmission in the market, then that's how much you owe him now, because the price wasn't set. If the price was set before, then yes, it's easy. But if the price wasn't set, Allah says, now you still owe him. But what you owe him is called ujratul mithl. That wage, that customary wage that is given for such a work in the area you live in. Maybe New York, it's more expensive than Florida. In New York, transmission will cost you $600. In Florida, it costs you $300, let's say. So if you're living in New York, you can't say, well, I'll pay you by Florida wages, you know. You can't say that. No, you got it done in New York. You're going to get it. You're going to pay according to New York money. That's what you're going to pay it. And it's like, for example, those Muslims, you know, who, when Ramadan comes around, you know, if it's winter time in America, they'll fast according to American time. Now, when Ramadan comes in the summer and the days become 16 hours long, they say, okay, you know, we are going to now fast according to Indonesian time. Where it's winter there. No, you can't do that. You live here, you gotta live according to the rules here and pay according to the money and the time here. That's how it's going to work. And so, whatever the customary wage is, whatever the customary idea of how much you owe is, that's what you will pay. My friends, this is called ujratul mithl. Did you understand that? Yes, send a salawat then. See, this is an issue of Sharia. This is an issue of Islam. Everyone knows this who knows the law. That the law says that if you didn't set a price beforehand, then whatever the customary wage is what you owe at the end of the work. And this applies to every work you take and everyone who's doing work for you. So now, understand it in this way, my friends. Understand it this way. When the Prophet came, he started teaching the people. People started learning from him. He started giving, they started taking. Prophet gave them prayers, Muslims took prayer. Prophet gave them fasting, Muslims took fasting. Prophet gave them all these things, Muslims took all these things. They took the Sharia, they took the law, they took everything from him. They made him work. So now, after making him work, when the bill was given to the Muslims, they looked at the bill and said, hey, wait a minute. You didn't tell us there was going to be a charge for this. You didn't tell us that there was going to be a cost for this. Now you can't say that. Now you made the Prophet work. Now when you made him work, now you have to pay for it. You have to give back. You have to give it. So now, if we say, all right, if the Muslim said, all right, how much do we owe you? Islam says ujratul mithl. So now when you go around and you check the different markets and the market for the work that the Prophet did and come out with a price that is right for that. But there's a technical problem. The work that the Prophet did is so unique that it cannot be found anywhere in history and any place in the world. So how can we set the price? So in this case, you have to go to the court. You have to go to the court and let them decide what the price is going to be. That is the reason when they asked the prophet, when the issue of the bill came, how much do we owe you for what you have done? How much do we have to give you for what you have done? Neither the prophet could say it, neither can the Muslims decide it. That's why Allah decided for them and said that the only price that is equal to the work that the prophet has done is the love of Ahlul Bayt. This is that price that Allah asked. That's why the prophet didn't ask that. That's why the Muslims could not say that. It is Allah who said it. Why? Because yes, there was no invoice that was given before the work. So when the work is done, only Allah could decide what the price of this work can be. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So shaitan, for him to make you do something, needs to promise you something. He needs to promise you something. You see, he needs to offer you something. But pay attention to this. This is really everyday issue of our life. Whenever that insinuation comes in your mind to do something wrong, there is an offer that shaitan is making in face of that command that he's given. There's an offer that he's making. Whatever offer is. Now the issue, what Allah is saying in this ayah, the first quality of shaitan is that whenever shaitan makes a promise, look back and see, has he ever kept that promise? Has he ever kept that promise? That's what Allah is saying. He will make you do something, he's offering you something. And then when you do it, he says, I have nothing to do with you. Don't ask me for a price. You said, but you said it's going to be fun. I lied. You said it's going to be enjoyable. I lied. That's what shaitan is saying. I lied. Shaitan's quality, the first quality of shaitan is that he breaks his promises. He breaks his promise. Anytime he makes a promise, if you want to trust shaitan, you can trust him, but he's going to break that promise to you. Really, he's going to break that promise. That's what Allah is saying. Inni bariyun minkum. This is the first quality of shaitan, my friends. Now, on the other hand, Allah also makes promises. Name me one promise of Allah. Just one promise. Jannat, good. Jannat is a promise, right? Allah said, if you do good, you will go to Jannat. You'll go to heaven, paradise. And paradise is gone. Yes. If I can explain to you what paradise is, you will fall in love with it. But I won't, because that's not my speech. Right? But the idea is, paradise is really good. I mean, I tell you, if you can just imagine what paradise is, right? Allah explains a little bit in the Quran, but really, paradise is good, right? Now, here, Allah makes a promise. Now tell me, one question that I have for you all, and this is what you really answer. Does Allah need to make a promise when He asks you to do something? Tell me, He told you to pray. He commanded you to pray. Does Allah need to make a promise, say that if you pray, then I'll do this? Allah doesn't need to make promises. Why? Because the very hands that you are raising towards Allah are given by Him. The very tongue that you use to speak is given by Him. The very eyes that you use to look towards the sky is given by Him. Whatever you have is given by Him. So Allah doesn't owe you anything. You owe Him for everything. You owe Him for everything. So Allah doesn't need to make a promise. Allah doesn't need to say that, well, if you do this, I will give you that. Allah doesn't need to do that. He just needs to tell us, do it. And you better do it, you know. And we have to do it. Because we owe Him for everything. We owe Him, my friends. My brothers and sisters, listen to this. So Allah doesn't need to make a promise. So when Allah is making a promise to you that if you do good, you go to Jannah, this is His favor on you. He doesn't need to do this. He is doing it as a favor on you. That listen, You, I am making this promise to you. Allah is saying that. Now recognize the difference between shaitan and Allah. Shaitan is someone who makes promises and then breaks them. Allah doesn't need to make a promise, but He makes them and fulfills them. The quality of Allah and those who are with Allah is that whenever they make a promise, they keep it. And the quality of shaitan is whenever shaitan makes a promise, he breaks it. So if you see the difference, now shaitan and Allah have been working opposite each other throughout history. Shaitan has sent, Allah has sent his religion, shaitan sent his religion. Allah made his house, shaitan made his house. Allah sent his messengers, the Prophet and Anbiya, shaitan sent his messengers, rock stars, bankers and lawyers. So when all these people came, they're working. Now, if we want to see if this messenger or if this person who represents Allah is actually Allah's or is he the shaitan's messenger, then we have to see the qualities. The quality is that if he's Allah's, then whenever he makes a promise, he will keep it. If he's shaitan's, then whenever he makes a promise, he will break it. Breaking promises is shaitan's quality. Keeping promises is Allah's quality. So let's start with the messenger of Allah, Rasulullah. Let's start with him. Tell me, is he Allah's messenger or is he shaitan's messenger? Is he Allah's messenger or shaitan's? Very easy. Everyone will say he's Allah's messenger. So if he's Allah's messenger, then any promise he has made, he must keep that promise. Any promise he has made, he has to keep that promise. If he broke that promise, then it means that he's not Allah's messenger, he's shaitan's messenger. He belongs to shaitan, not to Allah. Now the first promise that the messenger of Allah made, the first promise that he made to someone in his life as a messenger, in his mission of prophethood, the first promise that he made was in Dawatul Ashira. Was in Dawatul Ashira when he invited the relatives. He said, listen, whoever will support me, whoever believes in me, whoever is going to be a part of this movement right now and attest to me right now will become my successor and my wasi. Imam Ali stood up, 10 years old, stood up and said, I will be your supporter, I will be your aide, and I will help you, and I believe in you. So now Prophet looked at that and said, alright, then you, I promise you that you will be my successor, you will be my wali, you will be my wasi. So he made a promise to Imam Ali that he will be the successor of the Prophet after he dies, after he goes away. So now if that is the case, then now Muslims need to decide, if this is Allah's messenger, then it means he must have kept that promise. If he's not Allah's messenger, then he has broken that promise. Tell me, has he kept that promise or broken that promise? Has he kept that promise? If you believe that he kept that promise and Ali is the successor of the Prophet, then he's Allah's messenger. If you believe that Ali is not the successor of the Prophet, then you are saying that the Prophet is shaitan's messenger. This is, my friends, to prove Ali is the successor of the Prophet, you don't need Ghadir. Dawatul Ashira is enough for us. Salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Hence, the first quality of shaitan is that he breaks promises. He makes a promise and he breaks it. And this is the first quality that we see that is in shaitan. Now let me give you two examples. What happens when Allah makes a promise to us? When Allah makes a promise to us, He makes promises. You know, Allah has given an example of this beautifully in history. And I want to give that example to you today so you can see the differences, the difference of views that people have towards Allah's promises. Send us salawats. There are two characters that have been captured in history and have been presented to us, Islamic history, and have been presented to us. Their destiny was decided in one night. Their destinies were decided in one night. One night that was for one person, another night for another person. The first person, you look at this and you see the attitudes, you see the view, and you see the belief. From there, it's really interesting to see what this turns out to be. The first person that Allah, that Islam, the history of Islam shows us, is a person by the name of Umar ibn Sa'd. Umar ibn Sa'd was the general of Yazid's army in Karbala. That's where you know him from. Now, his night of destiny came when Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad offered him a proposal. He said, Umar ibn Sa'd, I want to hire you for something, make you do something. Umar says, all right, so see, what is it that you want? He said, you know, I want you to kill Hussein. I want you to kill Hussein for me. Umar ibn Sa'd is like, wow. It's not just a simple job, you know. It's not like, for example, you ask me to move your trash from here to here. You're asking me something big here, you know. So Ibn Sa'd said, yes, I know. But the reward is also big. I'm going to give you the city of Ray. Ray was a flourishing city in Iran. He says, I will give you that city. You will be the governor of that city. Now, on one hand, Umar ibn Sa'd has this offer, you know. The offer is laid to him. You kill Hussein, and in return for that, you get the city of Ray. There it is. So now what happened is that Umar ibn Sa'd said, all right, you know what? I need one night to decide on this. I need a night. And let me go through this and see how this works. You see, it wasn't easy for Umar ibn Sa'd. Really pay attention to these characters. Who was Umar ibn Sa'd? Let me tell you that. Umar ibn Sa'd was a person who, in his whole life, claimed to love Imam Hussein. Yes. Sa'd ibn Waqqas, his father, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was on his deathbed, and Imam Ali said and claimed and asked people to ask me anything and I will answer it for you. So Sa'd ibn Waqqas, the father of Umar ibn Sa'd, is the one who asked him the question, tell me how many hair do I have on my head? You know, just to make a joke and ridicule Imam Ali, right? He asked this question. Now, how many hair do I have on my head? So Imam Ali, you know, looked at him and said, listen, if I give you the answer, which I could, how would you verify it? How would you verify? Will you go and count? I mean, what kind of a stupid question is that, you know? Like, for example, you know, if you ask me, how many birds are in New York? I'll say, oh, there are about 1,208,000,000 birds. And how would you verify it? It's like a stupid question, right? You can't even verify it. So Imam Ali said, even if I give you the answer, you can't verify it. But let me tell you something. And he said two things. He says, you know, I have heard from the Prophet that on every hair of your, on every piece of hair that you have, there's an angel hanging on it. There is an angel hanging on it that is sending lanat on you. Right? That is cursing you. That's the first answer. This guy was like, why did I ask a stupid question? And I got what I deserve. Now the second thing Imam Ali mentioned is that, the second thing, let me tell you, your son is going to kill my son Hussein. This is a prophecy that Imam Ali made in front of people. People were listening. They saw that, they said, your son is going to kill my son. Now he only had one son, which is Umar ibn Sa'd. So now, this Umar ibn Sa'd, whenever he used to go around, walk around, people used to, you know, look at him and says, Hada qatil al-Hussein, this is the killer of Hussein. Oh, Hussein's murderer. You know? And like Umar ibn Sa'd would get upset. He said, no. You know, walk out, you know? And he came to Imam Hussein. He says, look what these people are saying. He came to Imam Hussein and he says, look what these people are saying. They said, I'm going to kill you. Now Imam Hussein didn't say whether you are or not. He says, listen, whether you are or not, only time will decide. Only time will decide. But these people are not stupid. Right? So, Umar ibn Sa'd, when he heard that Imam Hussein say this, he says, but how can I kill you? Ana uhibbuka, I love you. I love you, how can I kill you? This is Umar ibn Sa'd, who's claiming love for Imam Hussein. He says, I love you, how can I kill you? Subhanallah. Now this same Umar ibn Sa'd, who's claiming love for Imam Hussein, that night came to him, now he's been offered to kill Imam Hussein for the city of Ray. You know, all night he thought about it. And then he made a decision. He made a decision, and let me tell you his decision. I'm not making this up. Actually, he wrote it down in his diary, and that has been noted in history. He himself makes a decision, and he says, you know, I have thought all night and I have come up with a brilliant decision. A brilliant decision. Yeah. What is that decision? He says that I will accept the offer. I will accept the offer and I will go ahead and do what Ibn Ziyad asks of me. And why? This is what's important. The principle of his thinking. What his thinking was. Why? Because he said, Yazid is dunya. He is here. He's present. What is present in dunya is better than the promises Allah made in the akhirah. I haven't seen Jannah. I haven't seen the promises. I will take what is in front of me, which is dunya. I will take it and I will ignore the promises that I haven't seen. In other words, he says that the cash in dunya is better than the credit of akhirah. This is a decision he came up with. Imagine this. When we make decisions in our life, what kind of decisions do we make? You see, these are principles by which you make decisions. He made a decision and says, dunya is better than akhirah. I haven't seen Jannah. Did you see Jannah? Have you all seen Jannah? No. Have you seen Allah's promises of akhirah? No. Have you seen someone who's living there after death? No. So, why should I believe in that credit while I have dunya in my hand? Subhanallah. This is one decision that was made. And based on this. Now you keep that in mind. Now the next person that history recorded. The second person that history recorded when it came to the promises of Allah. That person's name was Hur ibn Ziyad al-Rihai. Hur, the night of his fateful night, or his night of destiny came on the night of Ashura. On the night of Ashura, when he saw that war is imminent, that these people are going to attack Imam Hussein, he was now in a confusion. Where is he going to go? What's he going to do? Because on one hand, he had everything in dunya. He had money, he was wealthy, he was rich, he had respect, he had honor, people looked up to him, people saluted him. He had everything. I mean, he was the man. When he used to go around, people used to stand up and say, wow, you know, here comes Hur. He was a champion. He was a hero of the people. Really, people looked up to him. This is Hur. And now Hur, that night of Ashura, when he saw that, hey, listen, I have everything here. And he was deciding that if this war is imminent, then you know what? Hussein is on the other side. Hussein is on the other side. And that Hussein is the key to Jannah. That Hussein is the key to Allah's promises. You see, he was deciding. And he decided, we know through history that one person from Hur came to him and saw him agitated, and he asked her, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong? I never seen you this way." The Lord said, "No, I'm just thinking." He said, "Are you afraid? Don't be afraid. You don't even need to fight. We'll go and kill Hussein."
Okay.
The Lord said, "No, I'm deciding. I have a decision to make." He said, "What is that?" He said, "I'll announce it." Now, you see this. Hur, in the morning of Ashura, he came in front of Umar ibn Sa'd. He came in front of Umar ibn Sa'd. Now remember, Umar ibn Sa'd made the same decision. And he wrote down his decision and he gave the principle for what his decision was. On the other hand, Hur came. And Hur came in front of Umar ibn Sa'd and said, "Umar ibn Sa'd, are you going to go on with this war?" Hur and Umar ibn Sa'd, it is imminent. It is going to happen. There's no way that this is going to stop. And then Hur said, "All right, if that's the case, then I'm leaving. If that is the case, I'm leaving. I'm going to Hussein and I'm going to join his ranks." Umar ibn Sa'd said, "Why? Why do you want to leave this? You know Hussein is going to die today. You know he's going to be killed today. Why do you want to leave this and go there?" And you know what? Hur's reply to Umar ibn Sa'd, and this is where destinies clash each other. Hur's reply to Umar ibn Sa'd was, "You know, for me, the promise of Allah is greater than the wealth of this dunya." See that decision. The principle of Hur's decision on which he joined Imam Hussein. He says, "The promise of Allah is better, is sweeter for me than what this dunya can offer. What I have in this dunya." Imagine this, two characters opposing each other. Stood in front of each other on the morning of Ashura. History captured these two characters, two opposing characters, and brought it in front of us so that every era and every generation that comes forward, whenever they make a decision in life, can decide. Are they deciding their life on the principle of Umar ibn Sa'd, or are they deciding their life on the principle of Hur ibn Ziyad al-Riyai? It's our choice. What is our life being decided on? Whose principle is it being decided on? Because one of those principles leads to Imam Hussein. One of those attitudes leads to Imam Hussein. The other will lead away from Imam Hussein. Really, my friends. This is the reality. You know, the treachery and the way that the enemies of Hussein fought Imam Hussein is a very ugly way. It was done in a very ugly way, really. These people who fought Imam Hussein, you know, it's like, for example, when you go to war, there's some ethics, there's some rules of war that you follow. The people who had animosity towards Imam Hussein had no rules. Really had no rules. They fought with him in a very unmanly, very disgusting and despicable sort of way. This is how they fought with Imam Hussein. You see, if they had fought with honor, then there would be some respect that you have for someone. But no, these people fought in such a way that they were disgusting. If you look at the attitudes of these people, you will see this. One old man, he can't even walk straight. An old man came to Umar ibn Sa'd while the battle is going on in Ashura. He says, "Give me a sword, I want to fight also. Give me something to fight, I want to fight also. And I want to get the ajr and reward of this jihad." So Umar ibn Sa'd says, "Hey, listen, just throw some rocks, right? And you'll get the ajr of reward, and the ajr and reward of jihad." So this guy goes and starts picking up rocks and throwing it at Imam Hussein's children. This is the people that Imam Hussein is fighting. These are the sort of people. I mean, really, I mean, look at you. You're 30,000 people. You're fighting less than 100 people here. You don't need to do all these things. Have some respect in this fight. No, they didn't have respect in this fight. You know, when Ali Akbar was hit, you know, he fainted on his horse. He fainted on his horse. The horse, instead of coming back to Imam Hussein, went into the army, in the midst of the army. The horse went into the midst of the army. And when the horse went there, you see, Ali Akbar was just fainted on the back of the horse. And these people, they saw that Ali Akbar. Now, you know, Ali Akbar was, you know, like very much resembling the Prophet. These people who were with Imam Hussein really didn't care about anything. When they saw Ali Akbar fainted on the horse, it's like, okay, this guy's fainted. He can't even defend himself. He's already knocked out. No, that did not stop them. They took that chance and they took out their swords and they just started hitting him and cutting his back up into pieces. This is, let him go. He's fainted on the horse. Why are you hitting him for? But no, these people were so despicable. They didn't stop there. This is who Imam Hussein was fighting in Karbala. These were animals, worse than animals, who he was fighting in Karbala. So now, Hur, when he decided to go, Hur decided to go. For him, all his life, he lived in wealth. Now he looked at the other side as he was leaving his camp to go towards Imam Hussein. He looked at the other side. He was ashamed because he was partly responsible for bringing them to this situation. He was shy. To him, the main question is, how is he going to face Hussein? Really, he brought him to this situation. He brought him to this catastrophe. And now he's walking and he's going towards Imam Hussein. Really, you know, for him, this is a whole world of change that came to him. If a person can recognize the change from falsehood to truth, they can recognize it through Hur. And when you see Hur going on the other side, you see a man who is so proud, who's an achieved man, a man who has achievements, a man who's the hero of the people, he's a champion amongst champions. And this person, he sees Imam Hussein and his head is bowed down. He unties his shoes and puts it on his neck. This is a way, a method, a way to show that I am feeling, I am submitted, I am ashamed. This is how in those days when people want to say that they're ashamed, they used to put their shoes on their neck and bow down. He came like that to Imam Hussein. And Imam Hussein would not let him feel low. He would not let him feel bad. Imam Hussein was the ultimate person who would make people feel good and make people feel good about themselves. And this Imam Hussein, when he knew Hur is coming towards him, and he sent out someone to greet him. When Hur was coming there, his servant was with him, and he came around there. Really, he looked at this, and he asked, what is going on? He said, someone is coming to meet you. Hur began to cry. He says, Hussein is sending someone to greet me. He's making me feel bad. Really, I already feel bad in front of Hussein. How is it that now Hussein is sending me this person? Really understand what Hur is going through. So now when Hur comes closer and the servant says that, Master, I see Hussein himself is coming to greet you. When he heard that Hussein is coming, he could not be on his horse anymore. He fell off his horse and he started to crawl. Imam Hussein saw him crawling and he came up to Hur, held his shoulder, and Hur said, I am sorry for what I have done. I am sorry for what I have done to your family. I'm sorry for bringing you here. And Hussein says, Hur, don't feel sorry, Hur. Don't be sorry. I am just sorry that you came to me before as an enemy and I was able to treat you like a guest. And now you came to me as a friend. Now I can't even treat you as a guest. I can't even offer you water to drink. And Hur said, please, Mawla, please, Master, do not shame me more than this. Forgive me for what I have done. And Hussein at that point says, Hur, you are forgiven by Allah and by me. You are forgiven. And then when Hur stands up before Hussein, that going down was the finish and the completion of an old Hur. And the standing up in front of Hussein was the standing up of the new Hur, who has now a different ideology, a different sight, a different goal, a different vision. Now when Hur turns around and sees the army that he has left, he cannot see human beings there. All he sees is empty faces. And now Hur is wondering, are these the people I used to care about? Did I lived all my life caring about the opinions of these people, these masses of faceless and meaningless people? I lived for these people. And then he looked around Hussein and really was thankful. Hussein, thank you for giving me this vision. Thank you for giving me this sight that now I have, that I can see what is truth and what is falsehood. All I see there is useless and meaningless people, garbage of the earth, scum of the earth, who are just standing there, who are meaningless in their life. And I, all my life, used to care about what they used to say, used to care about what they used to wonder about me. Thank you, Imam. Thank you for this vision you have given me. Anyone who comes to Imam Hussein, this is the vision that he gets. He sees the masses and he understands that their opinions are worthless. The only opinion that counts is the Imam's opinion, is Allah's opinion. And that's, now I have that on my side. Now I can go to war. And he told Imam Hussein, let me send my son to war before anyone else goes in. And Imam Hussein reluctantly agreed to that. And his son went into the battlefield and he fought with the army that he had left. And as he fought, he fell down. Hur, when he saw that his son had fallen down in the battlefield, he ran after and he wanted to see where he is. As he came about, he was asking, son, where are you, my son? Where are you? And he was looking for his son. And then he came to this place where his son was lying on the ground. But no, he wasn't lying on the ground. He was lying on the lap of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein was holding his son and he was crying over him. And Hur came to him and said, master, why did you bother to come here? I would have come. Imam Hussein said, no, Hur, no, you are a father and this is your son. It would be hard for you to bear the death of your son. Let me handle him for you. Hur was saved by that tragedy and that catastrophic emotion of having to see his son die. But Hur was spared of that. But Imam Hussein was not spared of that. When Ali Akbar had died, when Ali Akbar was dying, there was no one who came. It was Hussein who was on top of Ali Akbar. Hussein, who's going to spare you from this hardship?
Ya Allah, behak Ali, ya Fatir al-Samawat, behak Fatima, ya Mohsin, behak Hassan, ya Qadim al-Hassan, behak Hussain. Oh Allah, give us the tawfiq to hear the right thoughts. Give us the wisdom to understand your guidance. Hasten the reappearance of your Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. وآخر الدعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين ماتنا حسين يا حسين